Thanks, Janet. That is, if I let Randall enough time to fit in. But yes, I'll be kind and courteous for a change. How are you all doing? It's, as Dave was saying, it's an amazing day today. It's too good to be inside. And I was saying to Steve before, it's almost a sin to be inside on a day like today. So if any of you want to leave and go outside, feel free, and we'll forgive you. Nevertheless, looking around us in the world and the way that things are happening, it's a pretty grim picture on our news every night, whether it's world news or whether it's domestic. The situation in Syria is something that is agonising to watch and agonising to see how almost helpless even the great powers of the world faced with those kinds of situations. And similarly at home here, as we're in the throes of the federal election, it just seems to lurch from one thing to the next, from one day to the next. And as an expression of the same sort of issue, conflict, the inability of human beings to get along with each other, to respect one another, and, dare I say it, to love one another. Through all this, Christians from time to time take a morsel of bread and a sip of wine. And the question is, why? And perhaps more importantly, what on earth does such an act or such a ceremony, if you want to surround it with all the rest, what does all this have to do with the conflict going on around about us? On the surface, you could hardly imagine anything more irrelevant to the realities of life and life as a community and life as a world. In John 6, we have the record of how Jesus addressed not just his disciples, but also the crowd around about him on this matter of the bread and wine, although this was, of course, long before, well before, he actually designated the bread and wine as symbols, as reference points on the last Passover with his disciples. I don't want to go through the whole chapter, but just pick up with verse 53 towards the end, where the Jews were arguing with him. And Jesus said to them, "Very truly, in all truth, I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, the life that God has. And I will raise them up at the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me and I in them. Just as the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so the one who feeds on me will live because of me." Extremely powerful and graphic language. It's hard to bring the impact into the English that it would have had on the ears of the hearer, because he was talking about his own physical presence with them, eating his flesh. In other words, cannibalism. Drinking his blood, which is horrifying enough for us to contemplate drinking human blood. That's what he was saying. And of course, in the context, of course, that was something, even animal blood or any form of blood was forbidden for the Jews he was talking to. back in Leviticus 17. God banned any consumption of blood. And yet here's Jesus Christ saying, you not only got to drink blood, but also my blood. So why bread and wine? Well, the verses before give you a little bit of the background as the reason. And of course, there's a long section here about Jesus being the bread of life and connecting it with the example of the manna in the wilderness, which was the bread by which the Israelites lived for 40 years. It sustained them. But if he's talking about flesh and blood, and remember, these were actually made part of the command to take of him at the Passover, why did he pick up the bread and wine? I've always sort of surmised or looked at the wine, which is red, and said, well, that looks a bit like blood. Even a physical reminder. Maybe your mind doesn't work that way. But bread is nothing like flesh, nothing like meat. And here he was at the Passover table, and he could have picked up a piece of the Passover lamb and said, okay, use this, have a piece of meat, have a piece of lamb, and chew on that. In a sense, in the sense of tasting something or eating something would be much closer approximation to what he's talking about. So why did he land on bread and wine? There's a number of reasons. Some of them cultural, some of them significant connections that had been laid out before in God's revelation. Just to take a simple example, in Judges chapter 19, we have the episode of a man and his concubine during the time of the judges traveling and landing in a particular town just as it was getting near the end of the day, and they had nowhere to stay. And they were contemplating staying in the town square. And one of the locals warns them against doing such a thing. And we pick it up in verse 18. He answered, this is the Levite, as he was, travelling. He said, we are on our way from Bethlehem in Judah to a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim, where I live. I've been to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord. No one has taken me in for the night. We have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves, your servants, me, the woman, and the young man with us. We don't need anything. That's just one example, and you glean from the context the way in which bread and wine were basically representative of any food and any drink, or in some occasions, all food and all drink. And in other words, yeah, he was saying, we've got enough to get by, so we don't need to rely upon someone else. We just need somewhere to rest for the night. Similarly, another example, much later in the history of Israel, recorded in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs chapter 9. And this is where wisdom is being personified as a woman who is setting up a banquet. And it opens chapter 9 with a statement, wisdom has built her house, she has set up its seven pillars. She's prepared her meat and mixed her wine, and she's also set her table. She sent out her servants, and she calls from the highest point of the city, let all who are simple come to my house. To those who have no sense, she says, come eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Now, in the more literal translations, such as the RSV or the King James, it says, quite correctly, come eat my bread and drink the wine I have mixed. So bread and wine were essentials of any meal, not just the basics to get you by. But when you talked about bread and wine in the context or in the culture of those times, it referred to anything from a snack, something just to keep you body and soul together, all the way through to a very fine meal, a banquet, a dinner, special dinner and so forth, as in this situation. So when Jesus was taking the bread and wine, he was taking something that represented a meal. It represented food and drink that was the stuff of life. Not the staff of life, but the stuff of life. Now let's take another example. Genesis chapter 14. And if you can keep all these in the mind at the same time, this will be great. If you can't, do your best. Genesis 14 tells us the story of how Abram rescued his nephew Lot from the invaders and brought him back safe and sound. And verse 16 tells us he recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions together with the women and the other people. And after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh. That's the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And praise be to God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand." Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Now that would seem a somewhat tenuous connection to say, well, this is a connection with Jesus Christ. If it were not for what the book of Hebrews tells us about Melchizedek being a type of Christ, an anticipation of Christ. As the writer of Hebrews tells us, Melchizedek in Hebrew means the king of righteousness. King of Salem, translated, means king of peace. So the king of righteousness, the king of peace, and the priest of God Most High, which is what the writer of Hebrews is focusing mainly on, comes out to greet Abram, representing God and honouring God, the God who had delivered him or delivered the enemies into his hand. Second point to keep in mind. It was a celebration of a great victory, a great salvation, a great rescue. Now you may have heard or considered some of those before, but there's an even more obvious one which doesn't spring to our minds and yet was probably, if the disciples stopped and thought about it, the primary connection. Certainly in later years, I'm sure that they reflected upon it. In the Old Testament, under the Levitical priesthood, in fact, even before that, there were sacrifices. And the sacrifices all, in different ways, pointed to the ultimate sacrifice of Christ himself. They were there for atonement, to reconcile man with God, and to deal with the problem of sin itself. But whether you looked at a burnt offering, or a peace offering, or a sin offering, or a guilt or trespass offering, whichever offering, a morning or evening sacrifice, a new moon sacrifice, a sacrifice made on the festival days, as designated in the book of Numbers and Leviticus. Everyone was also accompanied by an offering of bread and wine. It was called, in the King James, a meat offering, sometimes in other translations now translated as a meal offering, and also a pouring of wine. So when Jesus took the bread and wine, he was there as the ultimate sacrifice and as the representative of what God was doing for his people. Now, when he was there, he was sharing time with his disciples. He wasn't there just as the dead body. And the purpose of his gathering together with them was to share things with them. The ultimate sacrifice, which pictured this kind of setting under the temple and the tabernacle period, was what is called the peace offering, or as the NIV calls it, the fellowship offering. This is what the NIV Study Bible says about it. Two basic ideas are included in this offering: peace and fellowship. The traditional translation is peace offering, which in turn is related to the Hebrew word shalom, meaning peace or wholeness. Thus, the offering perhaps symbolized peace between God and man, as well as the inward peace that resulted. You might remember some of the words that John recorded Jesus saying, "Peace I leave with you." The fellowship offering was the only sacrifice of which the offerer might eat a part. Fellowship was involved because the offerer, on the basis of the sacrifice, had fellowship with God and with the priest, who also ate part of the offering. This sacrifice, along with others, was offered by the thousands during the three annual festivals in Israel, because multitudes of people came to the temple to worship and share in a communal meal. During the monarchy, the animals offered by the people were usually supplemented by large numbers given by the king. At the dedication of the temple, for example, Solomon offered 20,000 cattle, 120,000 sheep and goats, as fellowship offerings over a period of 14 days. The Greek word that is used to translate the name of that offering, that peace offering or fellowship offering, is koinonia or koinonia. Koinonia is often translated communion. So we have a direct connection there between a meal shared with God in fellowship with God and his people, a meal which represents peace with God and with one another, and a meal which means sharing. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul makes reference to this in the context of the contrast between the pagan festivals, which had sacrificed, and coming together for communion. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 16. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks? And quite often the fellowship offering was also a thank offering, a thanksgiving offering, for which we give thanks, a participation, a communion, a partnership, a koinonia in the blood of Christ. And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one loaf, we who are many are one body, for we all partake, all share of the one loaf. Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate or share in the altar? And as what I read from the NIV study Bible, that in particular focuses upon the fellowship offering. So we read in Revelation chapter 3, just pulling some of the aspects of that together. Revelation chapter 3 to the church in Laodicea. Jesus ends up by saying in verse 20, "Here I am. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him, and they with me. To those who are victorious, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I was victorious and sat down with my Father on his throne. Whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches."